Good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to this episode of Black Hat Radio on Dark Reading. This is the second episode coming on the second big day of Black Hat, and we have a great information-packed show for you. I don't want to take too much time, but I do want to remind everyone that we would love to have your voice in the conversation going on right now at darkreading.com. If you're here and would like to take part, remember all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post, then be sure to click on that big red post button beneath the box. Well, with that, let's get on with our episode. Now, we've got two interviews, and just as in yesterday's show, what happened? The Dark Reading editors are all at Black Hat right now. So in preparation for the conference, they went and talked to some of our conference speakers beforehand. They did this during the last week or so, and we've got two more of these interviews for you today. In the first of these, we have Dark Reading Executive Editor Kelly Jackson Higgins talking with Alex Pinto, Chief Data Scientist of Needle and the lead of the MLSec project. Going to be discussing a presentation that Alex is giving at Black Hat this week, Data-Driven Threat Intelligence, Metrics on Indicator Dissemination and Sharing. It's a great interview. Let's go ahead and get things started. Over to Kelly Jackson Higgins.
This is Kelly Jackson Higgins, Executive Editor at Dark Reading, and I have with me today Alex Pinto, the Chief Data Scientist of Needle and the lead of the MLSec project. Alex will be speaking next week at Black Hat. His talk is called Data-Driven Threat Intelligence, Metrics on Indicator Dissemination and Sharing. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
Oh, it's great to have you. I appreciate you taking time to talk before your talk. I wanted to hear a little bit about your topic. It's really interesting to me because threat intelligence has pretty much been the big buzzword over the past few months in the industry, obviously. I feel like we're drowning in threat intelligence feeds, exchanges, sources, open source, commercial, all kinds of stuff. So I wanted to kind of understand what kind of drove you to sort of drill down into the threat intelligence space.
Well, it's actually, this explanation is a two-parter, right? And so a lot of what Needle does has to do with threat intelligence, right? We are a platform that actually applies data science and machine learning to help curate and help get better use of threat intelligence feeds, right? And not just consuming the raw data. And in order to get this work done, we actually had to figure out a way for us to evaluate the threat intelligence feeds that we were partner with or the open threat intel feeds that we were consuming for our product, right? So we had to divide, and we figured out that was actually no one really doing this work, no one really trying to measure, right, if a threat intelligence feed was good for you or was it being useful for you in any measure. I mean, most of what people would talk about would be, oh, I have this many more indicators than you have, right, as if the amount of stuff you have was some measure of quality, right? So actually the initial motivation of this, and this has been a research we have been doing both as part of the MLSec project and as something that Needle is pushing forward. It's been almost a year now that we have been gathering this data and trying to put some structure and helping people understand if whatever threat intel feed they're either just picking up from the internet or if they have the intention to buy a commercial feed, if that is actually going to be helpful for their environment and helpful for their defense strategy or not.
That's a really interesting point because one of the things I keep thinking is there's so many sources of this stuff out there. How much overlap is there? How useful is it? Are people really able to even, besides read through it, ingest it, actually apply it? And that seems to be the big question of a lot of these intel sharing platforms and mechanisms. So I think that's really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the type of threat intel data you were gathering in your project and kind of from where it came?
Sure. So we have been focusing on IP addresses and host names, like domain indicators, on this analysis. So when you think about people publishing blacklists or lists of, oh, these were malicious IP addresses and domain names, these were the ones that we gathered for this test, right, for these experiments, right? So we actually released with this presentation two separate open source projects. One, which is called Combine, which will actually let people gather the threat intelligence, the open threat intelligence sources that we did, so they can also have their copy at home. They can do the test at home with this data and whatever data they already have, right? And we also we're publishing all the calculations that we did. We actually have a package on a statistical language called R, where you can replicate the graphs, replicate the calculations that we did from the conclusions that we were coming we came up with during the talk, right? And it's funny that you mentioned about the overlap. This is actually one of the tests that we have. So we can actually measure from a group of threat intelligence feeds on a specific day, right? How much overlap was there between them? How much uniqueness you have, right? So if you have a bunch of these, how much of this data you can only find on one of these feeds, right? And we also have some interesting things about how long an indicator stays there in a feed, what's the age of the average age of an indicator, and how much do new things get added to the list and how much things get removed, right? You want to see something that is living. You want to see a threat intelligence feed where there seems to be constant research and constant new additions. And also, one thing that's even more important is you want to see things removed, right? Things that for some reason they have been cleaned out or they have been deemed to be a false positive. You want to make sure that those things are getting dropped out of the feeds, right? Otherwise, if you just keep adding stuff, eventually you're going to be blocking off all the internet. I guess you'd be secure, but you're not going to do much business like that.
You bring up a really good point, because I was speaking with someone recently about threat intel feeds and sharing, and they were basically saying that so much of the information they get, there's only a tiny little sliver of it that's really useful to them sometimes. This was a pretty big company. So it made me mm-hmm. wonder if there's just a lot of superfluous stuff out there, or like you said, a lot of duplicative stuff, or that may or may not apply, and that kind of thing. So were you able to measure like what percentage of stuff was useful and what wasn't, or what did you kind of come up with?
Yeah, so the overall conclusion of this stage of the research, right, that we got was that, of course, there is useful data there, right? Of course, if you have zero sources of threat intelligence, potentially missing out on things that it would be useful for your defense strategy, right? Mm-hmm. But the concept of trying to add more and more and buy more and more feeds for some sense of fulfillment, as in, oh, maybe if I buy all these providers, maybe if I ingest all these different feeds, then I'll be secure, is something that doesn't happen, because it didn't matter how many feeds we worked with, and the data set that we're providing and the results we're publishing is actually from 30 data sets, from 30 different feeds, there was still an overwhelming uniqueness between them. I mean, more than 90%, sometimes 95% of the information of the different IP addresses and domain names was specifically on a single feed, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that when people say that, okay, if you're just thinking about getting those feeds and just blocking on them or something like that, you're not trying to understand what the feeds are, trying to do something that's more intelligent with the feed information, you're not going to win the fight in any shape or form. There is definitely valuable information that can be extracted from this, but to think that, oh, I'm just going to buy these feeds and I'm going to buy all the feeds and then I've covered what evil is, right? I know everything that I should block, is a complete fallacy. It doesn't really work that way, because there's always going to be more. There seems to be a lot of blind spots there when you try to add it all up.
Does it seem like a lot of these feeds are pretty similar then? Is that what you're saying? Is it more like you only need a couple of them maybe
Actually, the opposite.
Okay.
So they're actually very different. Even groups that are targeting the same, feeds that are targeting the same groups, there's still not enough overlap to give you the impression that we are covering everything, right?
Okay.
So I'm not saying you shouldn't buy a certain health feed. What I'm saying is that buying them all doesn't mean you're going to be more secure than buying one or two. There's a lot of diminishing returns there, because it doesn't seem to be a good strategy. So, and because of this, that's why we turn to sharing communities, which is kind of the second part of this research. And we're trying to figure out if actually doing the threat intelligence sharing is something that would offset this problem. Because a lot of people raised to me when I was doing this this first part of the research that maybe threat intelligence, the sharing is the solution, right? And so we've actually been gathering the frequency of sharing, how many people in a community are actually sharing of the total of the constituents, and what kind of information they are sharing, trying to figure out the quality of this information as well, right? And we actually had two large contributors of data this time, which were both Threat Connect and the Facebook Threat Exchange system, right? And really trying to figure out if there is a better solution in sharing, and what does it mean to be in a healthy sharing community? I mean, what are the kinds of signals that you have there, right, from the data? If you're actually getting news out of sharing, right, or you are, I'm just there because suddenly it's cool to be sharing threat intelligence information now.
So what did you, can you share some of the findings you had there about the intel sharing, how useful it was, or when it was useful, when it wasn't useful?
Well, I honestly don't think I have enough different data sources to be able to make a general statement, but some of the hypotheses I had were confirmed, as in there's a lot of things that at least people who have been doing information sharing before this got into a more of a mainstream thing, right? There was a lot of concern that, well, actually it's just a different technology, we're just going to replicate the old patterns, right? So you see interesting things like, I mean, even if you have a large data sharing community, there's always like a very small percentage of it that will actually dominate and will be the people who will be actually sharing the information. The other ones will be just sitting there and hoping that something shows up that's going to help them, right? And you have some challenges. And there's another interesting thing, is the effect that having a kind of a driver or having someone who kind of oversees the sharing community makes a lot of difference on the quality of the data that you have. So if everyone shares freely, sometimes you have some questions about what's the maturity of the overall company there, you might get a lot more false positives than you would, even in an open feed, right? And sometimes the existence of someone who's curating that overall increases the quality, but usually seems to curtail people sharing more. So it's kind of paradoxical, right? If somebody's helping, people will think that they'll do all the work, right? Mm-hmm. But if no one is helping, no one is actually curating the experience, people will be more free to share, but you start to get some maturity and quality issues there. So it becomes a challenge. I think this is an important question, right? This is something that I hope to be able to research more, is what is the best approach, right? What's the optimal level of interference you would want to have in a curated sharing community or not, to make sure that people are sharing, they're actually helping each other, right, with good data, with data that's actually useful for everyone.
You mentioned the curated sort of moderated environment. Is that something that we see more in sort of these ISACs and ISAOs, or can that even just happen if you say you are a customer of Threat Connect or some of the other commercial feeds?
I think that's mostly happening in both, right?
Okay.
And specifically the ISACs, I would say that they're a little bit more mature in the sense, I mean, especially if you talk about FSISAC, right, they have been doing this for probably longer than a lot of the other groups there. And so they have actually coalesced in a scenario where you have multiple people of value there, multiple groups that are able to make valuable contributions, and the overall quality is much better, right? And I think this is exactly the kind of experience that people like FedConnect are trying to replicate, right? Mm-hmm. So that we can overall improve the sharing problem, right? I mean, is it really going to help? What is concerning me is that, I mean, there's more and more people excited about sharing, but they haven't even been able to put their first threat intelligence feed to work at their environment, or they don't really understand what the challenges are. And if you didn't do the homework at home, right, this is not the thing that's going to help you either.
What I keep hearing when I talk to people about ISACs and threat intel sharing is the big missing link is still being able to do something with the information in a useful way, an automated way. You know, the more automated piece to it is not there yet. Is that still what you saw? Is that what you saw as well in your research, that really there's, you know, you can ingest only so much, and then how you actually apply it and make it actionable, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is kind of the missing link.
Yeah, very much. And this is exactly the kind of challenge that we're addressing at Needle. So it's no accident that this is a subject that interests me very much, because, there's two different problems there. One of them is actually getting quality data, right? And we are very focused on trying to figure out what are the best possible sources of data out there, right, that a potentially immature a company with a threat intelligence team of multiple people, maybe tens of people, would really be able to leverage the best possible information from these sources, right? And our challenge, our mission, is really to try to automate that as best as possible, right? And try to bridge this gap. So if you already have the access to these good sources, we can help you put this to work on your environment. So I 100% agree with you that this is one of the major challenges that we're facing right now in the market.
Okay. So how would you, Alex, at this point, describe sort of the state of threat intelligence feeds and intel sharing ecosystem today? Is it sort of still in its infancy? Is it in its adolescence? I don't know if you could, if there's a way to sort of give us an idea of where it is maturity-wise.
Yeah, I would go with awkward teens, I guess. Yeah, I think that if you look back maybe a year ago, it was much less organized than it is today. And bear in mind, I'm not saying it's organized right now. But I think that I honestly think, and this is an exercise in futurology, that there's going to be more consolidation, there's still no agreed upon thing of what a threat intelligence provider should be able to give you, right? What is this? I mean, if you tell people I'm buying an IPS appliance, you know what to expect. If you're buying a firewall, you know what the feature list kind of is, right? Mm-hmm. So, and in a way, the threat intelligence, whatever this service is, whatever this information is, it's already fragmented the understanding and what the service offerings are. And it becomes interesting because it creates a lot of interesting interactions between the vendors. They soon figure out that they can help each other solve different problems, right? But that potentially is not helping the end customer, right? Until there's maybe a bigger consolidation there. I think we're moving in the right direction. But it took me a while to understand, and I think that I'm a part of this community, right? I like to think that I'm a part of this intelligence community. It still took me a while to understand. Imagine someone who's approaching this at the first time.
So I guess my final question for you is for those who might be interested in this area right now and sort of in the early phases, what do you recommend based on your research? I mean, should you have, you know, three or four different threat intel feeds? Should you be a member of, you know, three ISECs, or any sort of like general recommendation you would give to an organization that's still kind of new to threat intelligence ingestion and sharing?
Well, if you have the access, if you have access to an ISAC because of who you are, maybe you have a friend who's in there, they could potentially streamline, leapfrog you a little bit, right? But honestly, in a very little budget environment, right? Someone, okay, I'm just going to experiment with this, and see if it pans out for me. I would get started with a couple of open feeds, right? And I'm not specifically, I mean, I don't really mean specifically combine, but there are a few tools that people can use just to gather these open feeds and try to put them in a format that they could potentially ingest in their SIM or something like that, or create a process around this. It's hard, at least in my perspective, unless you can put the data to work, right? Unless you can actually make it a part of your processes, of your monitoring processes, of your review processes, right? Unless your team is actually trained to handle it, I don't see a lot of allure in buying a threat intelligence feed or something like that. I guess The problem people should be thinking about first is, okay, if I had this data, how would I use it? As opposed to just going there and buy the new, oh, this is the best data set because it got thousands and thousands of indicators per day, if you have absolutely no idea what to do with it.
Okay. Well, Alex, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for taking time to speak with us about your session at Black Hat. And
thank you.
Alex's talk at Black Hat is called Data-Driven Threat Intelligence, Metrics on Indicator Dissemination and Sharing. Thank you so much again, Alex. Good speaking with you.
Thank you.
That was Dark Reading Executive Editor Kelly Jackson Higgins with Alex Pinto here at Black Hat Radio by Dark Reading. Now, we're glad you're with us. We appreciate you being here, especially if you're with us live. If you are, please make sure you take part in the conversation that started here at Dark Reading. If not, think seriously about looking up our next episode. And here's a hint, it's going to be coming your way on August 19th, because the conversations really are superb. Another thing that's superb, of course, is the interviews that we provide. And our next one is Dark Reading Senior Editor, Sarah Peters, who had a chance to talk with Sean Moyer, founding partner of Atreides Partners, and one of the members of the review board for Black Hat. Sean is one of the people who gets to decide exactly which presentations make the cut to come your way here at Black Hat. It's a great conversation. It goes on for a few minutes, so let's get right to it. Sarah Peters interviewing Sean Moyer.
I'm Sarah Peters, Senior Editor of Dark Reading, and here with me is Sean Moyer, founding partner of Atreides Partners and member of the esteemed Black Hat Review Board. Sean, thank you for being with me today.
Hey, no worries.
Now, first of all, why don't you tell me what exactly does the Black Hat Review Board do?
We are actually, almost every member of the board is either, in one case, in the case of Ping Look, somebody who used to work for Black Hat. I guess there's a couple of people that used to work for the organization. But the vast majority of people on the board are just people that have been speaking at Black Hat and been involved for quite a while. So I've been going for 16 years, and I've spoke 10 or 11 times. That kind of theme is pretty common, but it's just people that have been involved for quite a while with Black Hat. We're just kind of a group of people that were asked by the organizers of the event to make the selections for all the different tracks. So you can kind of blame us for everything you see there. I get a lot of that every year. I always find out when people hate talks, and I also find out when they like them. And you know, we get credit for both of those things. It's gotten so big that we're also a little bit more siloed off. So, for example, I work on the mobile track, the embedded and hardware track, and a SCADA track, which is kind of small now. That's all of the submissions for SCADA and Smart Grid, and that's kind of it. So there's so many submissions now that there's no one member of the board that really reviews all of them, although a few people do try.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I'll ask you then, because it seems like, yeah, there's a lot of Android sessions on the program this year. Was that intentional, or did you just get a lot of really good submissions? Because I know that there hasn't been that one really big mobile malware event that has really, there hasn't been that one big breakthrough breach yet.
Yeah, and I think, well, and there have been, I will say sort of two things. If you look at it, there's been a couple pretty large malware outbreaks, specifically in Korea.
Okay.
You know, but not global. And the reason for that is with Samsung, Korea is a really high adoption. A lot of Asia, you've got Samsung, HTC, you know, a number of other Android vendors over there. So there's a really high concentration of both mobile phones and Android phones. There was a piece of banking malware that sort of bounced around South Korea and infected like a very large number of devices, like one of the few sort of real sort of mobile malware that really went out into the wild. But kind of beyond that, we don't really pick the platforms on mobile as far as what people submit. I think we're seeing more. Android just because, in my opinion, it's kind of the fact that Android being an open source platform, Google is somewhat supportive of this kind of activity. Apple's hard to work with, right?
Right.
For security researchers. And most of us that do any kind of Apple-related work are all embargoed and NDA'd, and we can't talk much about it. So there's been a couple mobile talks in recent years on iOS application hacking. Stefan Esser, of course, always... You know, that's kind of his world, is always kind of working on that. But, yeah, I mean, the last couple of years we've probably had more Android than iOS talks, and I think that will probably be the case for a while. But, yeah, I mean, on the big stuff hitting the Android world of late, obviously yesterday was pretty huge, the last couple of days for Josh Drake. I actually just saw – I was just looking at this earlier today – confirmation from Zimperium, from Josh's company, that there are people out in the exploit market selling already, you know, building exploits to sell that are based on Stage Fright and the 7 or 8 bugs that Stage Fright exploits. So I suspect that may be a case where we see more large-scale exploitation, but I guess I will say in general, one of the differences now between the way things worked in, you know, whether it be mobile or just sort of any kind of system exploitation, is that things like the Melissa virus, right? That was just silly, right? That was a really nerdy, autistic guy who had a crush on a stripper. It was just weird,
You
know? And there was no real payload. You know, this thing, its payload was to replicate itself, right? We saw that with Welcia and Blaster and Nimda and all these kind of things, you know, 15 years ago. I'm kind of dating myself now. All of that stuff was really just like, you know, effectively just kind of scripted-y stuff, people just sort of proving a point. In one case, I want to say it was Welcia, like one of those, it actually just replicated faster than the author thought it was going to replicate. Like it wasn't meant to be a mass-infecting kind of worm. Nowadays, we have professional exploitation. We have quote-unquote cyber war, which makes me want to throw open my mouth a little when I use that word. But we have nation-state exploitation that is very targeted against particular, you know, threat actors and stuff like that. So there's not a lot of point in mass malware. If you're sitting on, you know, a really juicy Android or iOS or Windows, you know, exploit, you know, you're not just going to release it into the wild, you know, for the purposes of a worm that does nothing but knock systems offline. Like, that's just kind of wasteful. I mean, the specific term people use, you know, in the exploit world for that is burning a zero day. You know, you're not going to make a zero day no longer be a zero day by pushing it out to half the internet so that everybody can take it apart and reverse engineer it and figure out what the bug it exploits is. You're going to use it in a very targeted kind of way. So, I don't want to say mass mobile or mass malware in general will never happen, but it is kind of less likely to. And you know, both for good and for bad, depending on sort of your political views of how the exploit markets work and all that other kind of stuff. We've definitely also got, in addition to like nation states buying up those vulnerabilities, we've also got, you know, companies like HackerOne and stuff that are buying them up, and you know, participation in bounty programs and things like that happening a lot. So the vendors are buying them up too. So there's not a lot of reason to waste one on some kind of big mass worm. But if that does happen, Stagefright is probably the right bug for it. That could be the case, right? So things that propagate remotely like that, you know, that scenario is something we've all talked about with mobile for a long time. And, you know, somebody out there may try to see if it's possible. We'll see.
You think that might be the thing that breaks it from not just the kind of individual consumer, but maybe into that big enterprise world?
As far as the awareness of mobile security, or?
In terms of the impact. Because I think that's kind of the thing with mobile, with any kind of mobile threat, is that it seems to, even if it is widespread, it seems to hit the individual person, you know, one at a time, as opposed to being able to be used as a way in to a large company to get after their whole database, like these giant breaches. I mean, it's usually that regular client desktop machine or laptop that's the way that these big mega breaches are happening that everybody's so excited about right now. I'm wondering if these stage fright vulnerabilities are that kind of thing that's going to be that next step, or if it's going to be something else that's going to hit the big name companies, or if it's going to hit all of us in this private and miserable way, and we're all just going to be upset because suddenly all of our secret videos on our Android phones are being exposed, but we're too afraid to tell anybody that we've been infected with some kind of stage fright exploit.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we do, our company does a lot of mobile security research. We do quite a bit with iOS and Android and other, you know, tablets and other platforms and stuff. And a lot of what we do is for enterprises. So we go in and enterprises have us do things like reverse engineer the latest release of iOS and figure out whether it's more secure than the release prior, you know, or do that, you know, with Android. And we also work with Android vendors on, like, you know, Android secure development. So, like, a lot of how we get paid is all about mobile security. But I would be hard pressed to say that a exploitation scenario that resulted in, say, a breach or a compromise of a large company, that scenario would be likely to happen via mobile devices today. It kind of gets blurrier, right, you know, as time goes on, because we have things like, for example, the Surface tablet, you know, which is really kind of just a Windows desktop in a smaller form factor, and all of our mobile devices get smarter and smarter to the point where they do become a replacement for your desktop computer to some extent, but they are still small embedded devices that have limited connectivity to somebody's corporate network compared to a desktop computer. I mean, we also do, like, you know, say we do mobile research. Like, one of the other things my company does is we do red teams, and I've been doing that, you know, for a lot of years now, where we get paid to basically simulate the attacker. Somebody says, you know, we want to find out if you can get to the engineering blueprints for our latest, our latest coffee maker. You know, Keurig has hired us to do it, which they have never done, that's why I can say that one. But, you know, they want us to find the blueprints for the new Keurig 4 with extra DRM or whatever it is. you know, if we do that, that scenario, and we have an open-ended scenario like that where we get to do that, but how are we going to get inside this company? Probably mobile devices are not going to, they're not even going to be fifth or sixth on my list of things that I would use to get inside a company. And, you know, it's just because I've got more computing resources and stuff with the desktops, and the desktops are going to have more connectivity. My first path in is probably going to be something like a phishing attack. You know, as far as affecting consumers, though, versus enterprises, like, so even if there was, like, sort of a really large mobile exploit like this, the thing we have to remember is that Josh is doing the right thing. Like, Josh is responsible with this. You know, it's disclosed to Google. It's got CVEs. So the reality is that the mobile enterprises, the enterprises with mobile devices that are mature and have mobile, which at this point should be pretty much everybody. I don't think anybody at this point has kind of had the, you know, sort of policy of bring your mobile device, put your corporate email on it, and we won't have any security controls around it at all. Like, people do that. They use MDM. They use things like Good Mobile and AirWatch and stuff like that, right? So every enterprise in the last 2 days that has Android devices that are in their corporate network, they're out actively patching and updating. Like, that's the reason that consumers are more likely to get hit with stuff like this, is because they're going to be less likely to patch. You know, my dad probably, I probably need to, you know, tell my dad to update his Motorola, right? But, you know.
Well, have you? You should get on that if you haven't done that yet.
You know, I actually not only have I not done that, but I haven't updated my Dodge Journey either. And I don't really put a real big priority on that either, for the same reason that it's probably not that big of a deal. We like to think that
yet.
It is. We like to tell ourselves that it is. But, you know, and actually I'll say that. It's the same thing I said about the automotive stuff, is that it's great work, and it's fantastic, and it raises awareness of this kind of stuff. But it is all the metaphors that come into my head are all probably, you know, off color, so I'll try to not use one. It is, in reality, that kind of capability, just like with JDuck bugs, that capability probably existed for nation-state threat actors, the kind of people that would go after me in the first place, right? Like, if somebody really wanted to do that, they already had that capability a long time ago, you know?
Right.
We're just now, you know, here in the cheap seats, hearing about this stuff.
Well, so we've talked a lot about how the industry has changed over the years, but I don't even know if you would remember this, but I remember roughly a million years ago, I interviewed you when you were doing a session with Nathan Hamill called Satan is on My Friends List about social networking vulnerabilities. And I mean, how has Black Hat changed in all of this time as the industry's changed and grown up, and how you have changed and grown up? How has the whole Black Hat kind of experience evolved?
I've done all I can to ensure that I've grown up as little as possible. That's probably my primary objective. You know, I will justify that
Bravo.
By saying that, you know, my job in the line of work we do is to think about bad things in a creative way. So, you know, getting old and ossified is probably not useful, you know, for that. But I've probably slowed down a little bit anyway. But it's funny, because my first thought was, you know, well, social network security hasn't really changed. It's about the same, you know, or Web 2.0 security across the board, I guess, or we're at 3.0, you know, has not changed a whole lot. All the same, I mean, I've always said, you know, we have actually understood the problem of information security since like the late 80s, early 90s, which is when Cheswick and Belevin wrote the book Building Internet Firewalls, and they coined the expression, you know, that which is not expressly permitted is denied. That's all we have to do. The principle of least privilege. We just have to enforce that everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's it, right? Like, that problem's the same. But, I mean, as far as the conference and what's changed, and I think the industry and what's changed, and I mentioned, you know, David Litchfield, you know, over the years, dropping 0 days, you know, at Black Hat, just, you know, Dave had for years, I'd love to get that story from Jeff Moss sometime, but for years, Dave Litchfield had a permanent slot on Black Hat for every talk, or like every Black Hat conference. There was just a line on the schedule, and it just said, David Litchfield, brand new 0 day. And Dave usually didn't even know what he was going to do till like the night before. Wow. I don't know which one I'm going to talk about. And then he'd just kind of write down some stuff and walk out with some slides or maybe even no slides and just drop an Oracle Zero Day, right? So when we did that social networking talk, and we did another one the year following, we were doing stuff that is potentially illegal now, in that we were presenting live demos of exploitation of vulnerabilities where we were using live websites. You know, some of the vulnerabilities that we found, you know, affected like 10, 20,000 systems, and we were getting people to click on it. Like, we were doing bad stuff with it, but we were getting people to click on our link and do whatever we wanted them to do, right? So over the last few years, that stuff's got tuned down further and further legally across the board, but also just from a corporate perspective, the conference organizers are a lot more leery about dropping zero days. That's not to say that it doesn't happen at conferences, but it's definitely a little bit more rare. I think, you know, over the years, the number of times where Black Hat's had to redact things. I remember back in the day when the Mike Lynn stuff happened, watching interns rip pages out of the, you know, paper conference program whenever his talk had to get pulled.
I remember that.
Yeah, so that was kind of, I mean, I think definitely back then was kind of more the Wild West. And not so much even, some people would say, well, that's because Black Hat's got big and it's, you know, it's all corporate. It's just like RSA. Well, no, not really. I mean, it's bigger for sure. But we've all done our damnedest to do everything we can to make sure it doesn't become RSA. I think it's more actually a reflection of the rest of the industry as well. I mean, keep in mind, Black Hat didn't pull Mike Lynn's talk. ISS pulled Mike Lynn's talk back then, right? You know, we had actually the example that comes to mind just recently. What is this? Rhino Security is the guys that had a talk on a wireless, like, sort of anonymity framework. I don't know if you even caught this. It was about a week ago. They pulled their. Yeah, it was an article. So I think Kim Zetter did an article in Wired about it. I don't know enough about the technology because it was all kind of conjecture to do an actual analysis of it per se. But it was a talk about a wireless anonymity framework that lets you basically it was just Wi-Fi repeaters kind of but over a different frequency. It lets you like drop one end of your sort of connectivity framework in like the free hotspot at McDonald's and access that from say 5 miles away. So it looked like you're at the McDonald's. This is very like Mr. Robot, you know, kind of stuff. But yeah, these guys, they pulled their talk. And they said not only did they pull the talk, but they had to destroy all of the devices. And nobody really even knows why yet. Whether it was, you know, there's a bunch of, did the FBI send them a takedown letter? I think most likely, and this is just a guess, that maybe they got like a legal letter from the vendor whose hardware they were using. But that's, again, that's just a guess. It could have been FCC. It could have been related to the radio frequencies they were using. But yeah, I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time. There was a point in time where we would, all of us as a community, would say, you know, screw it, we'll do it live, we'll just do it anyway. lawyers have gotten better at suing us than they were. You know, and the EFF has become a little more judicious about which cases they want to take on. So,
yeah, well, they'd be, you know, a little bit too busy if they tried to take them all on, I'm sure.
Exactly. Well, and there are ones that, you know, there's people who think that they, you know, have a legal right to, like, break half the Internet, you know, and disrupt, you know, critical infrastructure. It doesn't always work that way. So I think that kind of thing, like people pulling talks or gagging talks, I mean, we definitely see on the Black Hat board, even before the public side of it, we see talks pulled. You know, we pick up submissions and then, you know, see those pulled, you know, by the submitter, not by us, nothing to do with us, right? But
right,
we see
right.
stuff get pulled because their parent company's nervous or the individual's nervous. You know, people are afraid to take on big companies as an individual, and then their individual employers are, of course, afraid to do so as well, you know? I mean, heck, we're like a 7-person research shop. If we had a iOS zero day and we felt like the right thing to do was to drop it on the planet, which isn't really something we would normally do. But if we got that call from Apple's legal team, you know, we'd mm-hmm. probably decide it was less important, you know.
There's a lot of money behind some mm-hmm. of those legal teams. That's a, it's a scary proposition.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a lot of consulting money to be made by doing the work for those companies instead of just dropping stuff on them in the press.
That's a good point, too. Talking about that behind-the-scenes stuff, about the talks that get pulled before you even have a chance to look at them, what else is happening behind the scenes when you're looking at all of these things? I mean, do you guys on the review board have battles over who gets, you know, over which talks get in and which talks don't get in? Because I know Jeremiah Grossman's on that board, and I know that he knows a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, so I have to imagine that he wants something on it's probably going to get on. Or are there these all-night-long sessions where you're drinking a lot of coffee?
I do,
or what?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned I do mobile. I don't even touch web because Hamill's over there and Grossman and Arsnake and, like, five other people, and that's too much of a, you know, there's enough thought leadership already going on over there. I really want to stay away from that. You know, mobile is kind of smaller still. It's still kind of a niche. So there's just, you know, there's about four of us that do all the mobile. The way it works is that everybody that's declared their responsibility for a particular track, we have to review all the talks for that track. So we go through, and sometimes that means 100 talks, and sometimes it means 50. Depending mm-hmm. on the topic area. And sometimes it means 10, you know, which is one thing that I always tell people is if you have a submission for something that's kind of obscure, in a lot of cases, you have a better chance of getting picked up because of that. Like web, oh, shit, it's hard to get, you know, a web talk selected because you got like 8 slots and 150 submissions or something, right?
Yeah.
But if you have 8 slots and you have 10 submissions, you've got a lot better shot. So, those become in particular kind of highly contested. And sometimes what we try to do is figure out, okay, is there another subject area we're missing that we need to add that would break this down a little further? Like actually embedded and IoT now have split off. Last year we didn't have an IoT track, and I and a lot of other people argued that we needed an IoT track because we had so many embedded talks that were really more kind of consumer oriented and more kind of IoT. You know, mm-hmm. so when we do that, then that opens up more slots. But as far as how, you know, sort of how contested they are, it's pretty simple. I mean, we have a scoring system we all do that we vote on all the talks, and then we look at the top scoring talks, and then we sort of give everybody a veto as well. You know, so if you have, you know, four people and somebody's a really strong, you know, this talk sucks, or in particular, you know, which we do have, we've seen this guy before and it was terrible, or, you know, this person right. had a history of not delivering on talks, or, and this one happens, Charlie Miller and Chris Dallas have a great talk, they didn't fill out the submission, let's say. That never happened, you know, that never would have happened. And actually, I can think of a number of years where we've had people we know do great content, but we don't have enough to base the review on because they haven't filled the damn review out, or the submission out, or they have,
right.
And what happens a lot, they have legal embargoes in place, and they can't reveal exactly what the talk's about yet, even to us, because they don't have permission yet from the vendor. And so they have to be really vague. But so when we have that kind of thing, I mean, we all sort of debate it. And then, you know, what will happen is we'll sort of haggle on, you know, whether we reduce the score for something or raise the score for something. And then we, you know, beyond that, we just go off the score. You know, the top rated talks are the ones that get through.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so any other tips out there then for the people submitting abstracts? Because there are a lot of new faces that are on the program this year, which is great. So how, if you're one of those people who wants to be a new face on the program next year, how do you sneak in?
So I've always said, you know, like I said, I've spoken at Black Hat a whole bunch of times. And really the things that got me to get accepted probably haven't changed much. you know, I always said, you know, the fact that I'd spoken at Black Hat a whole bunch of times doesn't make me a good security researcher or even a good anything, except it does mean that I'm pretty good at getting accepted to Black Hat. You know, like that was my skill. And so the biggest thing that I always did, and I think this is still absolutely true, and I tell people this all the time, is never err on the side of less is more. The more information you give and the more you fill the submission out, the more we have to go on, you know? So, I mean, like, that's the number one thing is just people not filling out enough content, you know? So the thing I always did, and this still, in my opinion, everybody that does this is most likely, you know, has a better shot. I actually made all my slides beforehand, and I wrote my abstract, and I wrote all my bullet points, and wrote my outline, and maybe the slides weren't as done as they would be 2 months later when I did the talk, but I'd submit the full talk, you know? Here it is already done. Honestly, knowing that somebody actually already has slides, considering how difficult it is to get people to have slides and to show up for the conference, knowing that both of those things are already complete and that they already have a slide deck, you know, goes a long way. And it gives you something to go on, where a lot of people are just kind of, they have a vague abstract and they're not done. And so a lot of people argue, well, why should I work on it before it's accepted? Well, you should work on it before it's accepted, because then if you don't get picked up there, you submit it somewhere else. But that's just showing that extra effort there, I think, makes a big difference. All the other things don't work. Appeals to the greatness of the Black Hat board. I'd be honored. It never works. I love that one. I get that a lot. It would be an honor to speak here. It would be an honor to receive a complete submission from you, sir. You know, so there's a lot of other, yeah, prevaricating or you know, invoking some, I don't know. The worst are the ones that are written by the company's PR person instead of by the submitter. That's actually become an automatic disqualifier, which is good.
Okay, good to know. Definitely. You can always tell when somebody in their legal department or their PR department has gotten their hands on and taken all of the actual interesting content out of something. Like, oh, right,
they take all the soul. Yeah, exactly.
400 words of absolutely nothing. Well, Sean, it's been a delight to talk to you. I hope you have a wonderful Black Hat. Is there anything else that we should know before I let you go?
Drink plenty of fluids. Drink plenty
That's
of fluids.
Good advice
and remember,
for any
remember,
conference.
It is not a sprint. It is a marathon. You don't peak too early. Slow and steady wins the race.
Excellent. Good advice for us, but certainly usually at Black Hat. Thanks again. I'm Sarah Peters. That's Sean Moyer, founding partner of Atreides Partners and Black Hat Review Board.
Cool. Thanks.
Good advice. And the second of our great interviews here on this episode of Black Hat Radio by Dark Reading. We had two great interviews today by Kelly Jackson Higgins and Sarah Peters. We hope you enjoyed both of them. Now, for more from both of these correspondents, and for a wrap-up of the important things that happened at Black Hat, plan to be with us on August 19th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for Dark Reading Radio. It's going to be the Black Hat wrap-up episode, and it is going to be outstanding. Put it down on your calendar now. Check back for the URL here at Dark Reading very soon. Well, for Sarah Peters, Kelly Jackson Higgins, and everyone at Dark Reading, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you on the 19th.